My name is Harriet Tramer, and I hope you will join me every other Tuesday at this time when I host Reaching for the Gold. My two guests today are both working to help not only the elderly, but also the companions who can give them the support they need if they want to remain active and healthy. Dr. Carol Osborne treats animals, having board certification in gerontology. She pays close attention to the connections between the way animals pass through their aging process and the way that humans work through these same markers. Abby Marchand, meanwhile, works with PHI National as that group's Associate Director of Policy Research. This organization helps to upgrade the professionalism of direct care givers. Dr. Carol, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Harriet.
Okay, we talked before a bit about one medicine. What exactly does that mean? Explain to us.
Well, what one medicine is a very exciting situation, and it's literally exploded. One health is defined as the integrative effort of multiple disciplines working together locally, nationally, and globally with the goal of obtaining optimal health for people, for animals, and for the environment. The concept behind One Health has existed for centuries, starting with Hippocrates, estimated at 400 BC, in his statement on air, on water, and on places. All kinds of great people have worked together, from Louis Pasteur to Robert Koch, all the way to Dr. Schwab, who actually coined and captured the term One Medicine in his book, which was entitled Veterinary Medicine and Human Health. And it was in honor of this gentleman that the AVMA, or the American Veterinary Medical Association, initiated its One Health Task Force. So the reality is this is a huge global effort between human doctors, osteopathic doctors, veterinarians, dentists, nurses, and Harriet, all kinds of other scientific, health, and environmentally related disciplines, from the American Medical Association to the American Veterinary Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Nurses Association, the American Association of Public Health Physicians, as well as the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene, the CDC, which is the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the USDA, which is the Department of Agriculture, the National Environment, the National Environmental Health Association, along with 700 other prominent scientists, physicians, and veterinarians worldwide that have basically endorsed this initiative. So to make that long story really short, what we're trying to do is link human health, animal health, and environmental health so that we can recognize situations that are going on and that need to be addressed as they are, and try to address them and foresee these situations. You know, Harriet, the truth is human health, as well as mental health, animal health, as well as our ecosystem, are all, as you well know, inexplicably linked. So One Health, the concept, it seeks to promote, improve, and defend the health and well-being of all species by enhancing the cooperation and collaboration between physicians, veterinarians, nurses, and other individuals engaged in the scientific health and, you know, environmental community. We're trying to, promote strength and leadership and looking for management to achieve all these goals.
Before we go on, I would like to remind my listeners that you can call in and ask questions at 1-888-627-6008. Again, 1-888-627-6008. Now, you mentioned, and it's fascinating really, that this idea of One Health can be taken back centuries.
Yes.
why do you think it is getting so much attention now? Why is that happening?
Well, Harriet, that's another great question. Right now, actually going back a few years, in 2011, the world's total population exceeded 7 billion people. And obviously, it continues to climb. So what is the result of that? As our population expands geographically, the contact between human and wild animal habitat increases. What does that do? Well, that introduces the risk of exposure to new bacteria, new viruses, and other disease causing agents. So what are we talking about? For example, let's take the flu. It's winter here where we live, and a lot of people have the flu. So the flu is an example of a zoonotic disease, or a disease that is transmissible between humans and animals. So now we're on the epidemiology side. Normally, influenza spread from the pig to the bird to the person. You probably remember back in 2009, we had a pandemic of swine flu with that H1N1 virus. Okay, well, one of the things that One Health does, these people collaborate, again, veterinarians and human physicians, to try to figure out how this transmission is occurring, how this virus mutates, and what we can do to protect the health of everyone involved, human and animal alike. What's interesting, Harriet, is that what's happened lately is that we've had a reverse zoonosis. What that means is that people are able to transmit the flu virus. So if you're sick and you're running around sniffling and sneezing, and you've got a dog or a cat in your home, here's what's happening. Your sniffles and sneezes, or the human flu, is being transmitted to the house cat. And the house cat is then acting as a source to infect other people, as well as dogs, ferrets, and as I said before, humans. So one of the things that one group in this task force is working on is they're trying to figure out if cats are going to replace pigs and birds as the infection source when it comes to the flu virus. That's pretty interesting for all of us, and also has proved fatal and cost millions of dollars and taken many, many lives. Speaking of diseases, which are these zoonotic diseases, or the diseases transmissible between animals and people, ticks would be another example. Let's say Lyme's disease. That's a disease, one of six diseases, transmitted between let's say the tick to the dog, and then of course the dog is able to transmit it to the human if some of that urine might splash on an open cut or even just a mucous membrane in the person. So that's another disease entity, affecting people and pets. Treatment is the same. Doxycycline works great for both, but again, it's a very insidious disease that can result in awful pain and suffering for people that have it but don't realize that they have it. And in a lot of these cases, human physicians look to the veterinarian because as veterinarians, we are trained specifically in many of these situations with different insects and vectors transmitting diseases through humans. Where else do these concepts of One Health come into play? Well, Harriet, let's take a look at cancer. Cancer has become the leading cause of death. I think that it may have even surpassed heart disease as a leading cause of death in humans. It has maintained as the leading cause of death in pets. But here's an example. Let's take bone cancer. We've got some researchers at Auburn University, and they're testing a new bone cancer therapy on dogs that holds hope for humans with the very same condition, understanding that in humans, the majority of people affected by bone cancer are young children. Very, very sad, a horrible, painful situation. But this new bone cancer therapy consists of injecting a modified virus that's normally used in the canine hepatitis vaccine. They modify the virus. They then inject it into the cancer cell. And what it does is it creates millions of copies of itself, causes the cancer cell to die and rupture. And the bottom line in this is that we're looking to cure bone cancer, not only in dogs, but also in humans. And because dogs are physically and physiologically very similar to people, the types of cancer as well as the genetic mutations affecting dogs are very similar to those affecting people. Consequently, what the researchers discover in dogs in many cases is, in fact, very applicable to people. Now, on that same line, Harriet, the fact of the matter is 80% of human and dog tumors or cancers are indistinguishable, and that is in the laboratory. And that goes back, you know, ever since they've realized that the canine or the DNA makeup of the dog is nearly identical to that of the human, these studies have come into play because researchers have realized that physicians can learn a lot from veterinarians and vice versa. So these big human schools have gotten together with several veterinary schools and vice versa to pinpoint diseases and to try out therapies that would ultimately be helpful and applicable for humans and pets. So what they're doing, for example, in the breast cancer situation, is because a dog has approximately 7 mammary glands, whereas a human just has 2. What they're doing is they study these tumors on a molecular level, looking for genetic markers that can give us clues as to how human breast cancer tumors progress and which ones are likely to become malignant. Now, they're doing fundraising efforts similar to the Susan G. Komen Cure Foundation, and they're doing this in 40 cities around the country. And this is called Puppy Upwalks, and there's another funding link which is called 2 Million Dogs, and that's looking at breast cancer. What about vision? There was a recent publication released through Michigan State University in which they were able to combine 2 therapies together to reverse an inherited form of total color blindness in dogs, which is called achromatopsia. Now, they use a protein called CNTF, and what it does is it selectively destroys the eye light-sensitive cells, which vets call photoreceptor cells. It's kind of like pruning a flower. And they follow that with gene therapy, and the success has been overwhelming. All 7 dogs in this study regained full vision. Understanding, Harriet, that these photoreceptor eye disorders constitute a major cause of incurable blindness in dogs as well as people. And
okay,
now,
because
of the tremendous success of this therapy, new treatments and concepts are being investigated for retinal therapy disorders that also cause blindness in people and pets.
Okay, a few things. You're touching on some very sensitive issues here.
Yes.
Very sensitive. Number one, if you talk about animals transmitting diseases to humans, that can be understood from a scientific standpoint as being important knowledge because it can help people understand or professionals understand how they can better prevent these illnesses, the spread of these illnesses.
That's exactly correct.
But couldn't talk like that create a panic by people who just don't quite understand? Like, I can't go out because I might run into a dog, and the dog has this or that. Can't these things cause panic?
Well, you know, Harriet, they could, but the reality is, panic is not the word that we're looking for. What we're looking for is education, and a collaborative effort to get the word out there, to help people understand, and then to get our professionals to try to find ways to stop the transmission, you know, and to find cures applicable to people as well as pets. I mean, understand, just this is a very small level, but dog feces often contain roundworm eggs. The eggs are microscopic. But should a little toddler be on the floor acting the way toddlers act, and they kind of lick and sniff everything, if that toddler happens to rub their hand on an area of the carpet that might have a microscopic egg, and then put their hand to their mouth, that child will ingest roundworm eggs from that house dog. And if that is not recognized and treated ASAP, that can cause total blindness for that young child. So it's not to get us to panic, but on the other hand, to get us to learn, to understand, and to work together to try to make the world a better, safer place for everyone, humans and animals alike. Does that make a little more sense?
Yes, of course it does. But one other thing you are touching on that is almost explosive. When you talk about the DNA of dogs being just very, very similar to the DNA of humans,
It's over 98% identical, but go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
That's all right. You're talking about evolution, from what I understand, and that's explosive. I mean, a pretty high percentage of the American public, and I'm not saying this to degrade anybody, I'm just saying it's the way it is, claim they don't believe in evolution. You're touching on some pretty sensitive points.
Absolutely. I mean, evolution is a fact, but the fact that our technology has allowed us to identify DNA and to begin to identify genetic markers that can tell, for example, Angelina Jolie. That's a big movie star that just about everybody knows. She went to her doctor, saw that her genetic markers for breast cancer were very high. She elected to have a bilateral mastectomy to try to prevent breast cancer from afflicting her, because her mother died at age 56 from breast cancer. So, you know, you can look at this in a lot of different ways. Some people don't want to know, you know, what they might get, but again, many of us do. But the real beauty, in my opinion, in all of this, is that we're coming up with and we're realizing that, particularly between the dog and the human, and that doesn't mean we don't love kitties, because we do, but their DNA is not quite as identical as the dog's is to the person. So we're going on here with food safety. I mean, one of these things is, how are we going to get enough food to feed all the people in this world, Harriet? With 7 billion people and the numbers skyrocketing, one of these initiatives is to find ways to establish protein sources and food sources to feed the world's population. So one of the things that was started about 27 or 28 years ago, and this is the other side of the coin, is GMOs, genetically modified organisms that are being used to grow our food. At this point in time, the milk, soy, beets, just about all the carbohydrates, the soy, the wheat, the grain, are all being grown with GMOs. And although the GMOs have made it so that we were able to protect our crops from insect damage and from drought and environmental conditions that the farmers couldn't deal with previously, the problem with GMOs, which is just coming out today, is that these GMOs are being linked to cancer, to diabetes, to a host of autoimmune disorders that, once again, are not only affecting you and I, Harriet, but it's also affecting our beloved pets. So now, was the pet industry aware of the carbohydrate and the GMO situation many, many years ago? Absolutely. Why did they come out with California Natural and Innova? Those are grain-free foods. They came out with those grain-free foods because they're well aware that the grains, the corn, the wheat, the soy, etc., are genetically modified. They have serious detrimental effects on human and animal health. So one of the ways that the dog food companies decided to eliminate this obstacle was to come up with these grain-free diets. So, you know, in a way, it's kind of a double-edged sword. Certainly, we do need to find ways to grow and produce sustainable food to feed the world's population. But on the other side of the coin, and in my profession as a consumer and as a veterinarian, we need to seriously look at these methods of food production to be sure that although they might look good for the short term, the potential long-term results, at least with GMOs, is proving to be quite devastating. And that's an answer that will vary depending upon who you speak to. You can take, for example, melamine, cyanuric acid, these different chemicals that are being added not just to pet food, but folks, also to human food. Go to infant formula. You know what you're going to find in that infant formula? You're going to find melamine. And does melamine do all kinds of nasty things? You bet it does. Melamine was one of the agents involved in the 2003 and the 2007 menu pet food recall. We lost over 250,000 pets. Why? Because the melamine, which is always in there, combined with something called cyanuric acid. Cyanuric acid is a chemical used to clean swimming pools. Well, APCO allows cyanuric acid to be put in pet food, and I quote, to artificially inflate the protein content, end quote. What they weren't counting on is that the melamine combined with the cyanuric acid in what we call the proximal kidney tubules, which just means the early part of the kidney, it caused acute kidney failure and the consequent death of over 250,000 dogs.
Now, so, on this show, we concentrate on aging. What can we learn from animals that helps us better understand the human aging process? You have border certification in gerontology, dealing with older pets, dealing with how they age. What can we learn from animals that might tell us something about human aging?
Well, we've learned a lot, and the fact of the matter, Harriet, is that approximately 90% of the degenerative disorders that we associate with aging in humans as well as dogs can be reversed, retarded, or delayed by addressing diet, nutrition, and antioxidants. Now, when I talk about these diseases, I'm talking about cancer, arthritis, diabetes, kidney, liver, and heart disease, just to begin with. So let's talk about antioxidants. What is an antioxidant? Well, antioxidants are the vitamins, minerals, and the enzymes that play a vital role in preventing the onset of chronic diseases in humans and pets. As I just said, diabetes, cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's disease, along with allergies and cataracts. So let's see, what does an antioxidant do for a human or a pet? Well, it's estimated that a human cell is roughly exposed to approximately 100,000 free radical hits per second. What does an antioxidant do? Well, it mops up those free radicals. It gets rid of them. So it prevents those free radicals from harming our body. Free radicals damage our body much the way that oxygen causes metal to rust. So What can we do about that? For example, vitamin E and coenzyme Q10, those act as antioxidants. They attack those free radicals that would normally be hitting the DNA not only in you and I, but also in our pets. Coenzyme Q10 protects the heart.
Now, how has all of this affected the way you personally look at your aging and the aging of people around you? Many Americans, many people as a whole, are frightened of aging. Has this changed your outlook?
Not only has this changed my outlook, it has broadened my outlook and made me realize through my patients that simple changes in diet and lifestyle can make a huge impact on your potential health destiny. And what I mean by that is that the length of our lifespan and the quality of our life is affected by two things: 30% genetics and 70% lifestyle. So what that means in English is, although there's not much we can do about how we were born, be it a human or an animal, what we can address is our lifestyle, meaning our diet, our daily habits, our daily exercise, for example. And what that means is, by addressing lifestyle, you have a 70% chance of changing the odds into your favor as a human or as a pet. And I've been able to document those changes not only in myself, but also in my patients, by doing, as I said earlier, just simple things. Cancer is a big one. We've had wonderful results in extending the lifespan of many of these dogs with lymphoma cancer. That's the number one cancer hitting dogs right now, especially the golden retriever. Very common in humans as well. Chemotherapy, unfortunately, it helps less than 3% of the individuals, people or pets, that receive chemotherapy. On the other hand, many of these natural nutrients combined with very specific diets have offered these pets, in my clinical experience, we get approximately a 2-year lifespan of extremely high quality life, where the dogs are doing so well that sometimes the owners come back to me and they say, "Dr. Carroll, my dog is doing so great that if I didn't have this piece of paper in my hand, which is the biopsy report from the tumor, I would never believe that my dog had cancer." When it comes to, let's just say, you know, diabetes. Diabetes is soaring in humans. It's also soaring in pets. For example, one of the initiatives that is currently going on in this one medicine is they're investigating chelation therapy in that it reduces cardiovascular events, heart attacks and death being very specific, in these people with diabetes. So what that means in English is that the National Institute of Health, which is also involved in the One Health Initiative, has funded clinical trials to assess the value of chelation therapy in older patients with diabetes to protect them from death by a heart attack. And that is as valid in people as it is in pets. And the initial results that were published, and it hasn't even come out yet, last year, 2013, in the Journal of the American Medical Association, showing that there is a mild reduction in heart attacks in older individuals with diabetes that receive EDTA chelation therapy. Chronic pain
is... very much for being on the show. And if people would like to reach you to learn more about One Health, how can they do that?
Well, your listeners can call us toll-free. We're here in Chagrin Falls, Ohio. Our toll-free phone is 1-866-DR-CAROL, and that's 866-372-2765. They can visit us online at blog.carolonpets.com. And for those people that live in the Cleveland area, we've just opened up the first integrative center of pet wellness for dogs and cats in northeastern Ohio. It's the Sugar Falls Veterinary Center, and that's right here in Sugar Falls, Ohio. So we welcome your calls, we welcome your questions, and we'd love to meet you and discuss this with anyone that might be interested.
Abby, welcome to the show. PHI National works with direct caregivers, helping them to upgrade their skills, become more professional, do a better job for themselves and the person for whom they're caring. How did this group get started? Did people outside of that profession start it? Did people in that profession start it? How did it get started?
PHI started, it actually came out of an organization that was a worker-owned cooperative home care agency. It really started at the agency level, and it grew out of that as an organization that would work to improve the training and the skills for the direct caregivers, the direct care workers employed at that agency. And it's actually grown really over the past 20 years to be much more than that. So our organization does not only the actual training for direct care workers, but also we provide organizational development consulting, so we help organizations improve their culture, like nursing homes and home care agencies. And then we have a public policy arm, which is where I do my work, and we do policy research at the national and state levels, and we also do advocacy on workforce issues that relate to direct care workers, like wages and benefits and training. So we do public policy as well.
Now, would you consider your work to be cutting edge in the sense that the number of home health care aides or aides working in nursing homes is constantly increasing? It is one of the few growth industries in our country. Do you consider then the importance of this organization to be constantly evolving?
You know, yes, I would put it exactly like that. I think that, you know, there's actually definitely increased attention to the workforce and the demand for long-term care and the long-term care workforce. So, like you said, we are seeing growth in these jobs, even in the midst of a pretty slow economy. You know, actually, home care workers are projected to be the second and third fastest growing occupations over the next 10 years. So we're really talking about very dramatic growth in this workforce. So we've definitely seen a growing interest in the work that we do on policy and advocacy, and also, you know, in training. We see a lot of states that are interested in improving the standards that they have for training these workers. And, you know, we play a role in a lot of that work, and it really aligns with our mission.
Now, I have heard it estimated that the number of healthcare workers, direct care workers, will increase to 5 million by 2020, which is not so far off. Do you think this increase is due to the fact that our population is aging? Is it due to the fact that more and more seniors are aging at home? Is it due to the fact that increasingly more women are working outside of their homes? Why is this happening?
You know, it's really, I think, for all the reasons you just mentioned, it's some combination of those things. We definitely see that there's increased demand for long-term services and support just due to the demographic aging of the population. And people are living longer, and they're also living longer with chronic diseases, and they may require more assistance. And we also see an increased preference across ages for people with functional limitations to get those services and supports in their homes and communities. So a lot of people prefer that setting. And so we see in particular a lot of growth in the home care occupations over more institutional based settings like nursing homes. So we see a lot of the growth happening in home care. And then, you know, because of that demand, we definitely see that there are a lot of people who might not otherwise do this kind of work. They're moving into these jobs because there's actually jobs in this industry and jobs doing this kind of work. So it's one of the few areas where there's actually job growth. So we see, you know, that it's pulling a lot of people in because of that.
Possibly one other factor is we have a society in which more and more people are, for lack of a better term, outsourcing a lot of work. In other words, you get a lot of service industries that are growing, whether it's hairdresser, home health care, personal trainer, personal dresser, personal banker, financial advisor, whatever. These service industries are growing. Possibly because people are very busy and need to have somebody helping them, possibly because we have such a specialized society and economy that people need the help even if they do have the time.
You know, that's a really interesting point, yeah.
Our unemployment rate, as you obviously realize, is quite high. Now, do you think, and I don't know if it's going to happen, I have no way of knowing that, do you think a government-sponsored program that would train people to be home health care aides and pay them to be home health care aides might in some way be an aid in bringing down the unemployment rate? Might some of the people, for example, the unemployment rate just came out for December. It's not great. It's thought that many people have simply dropped out of the job market. Might government training programs and government payment for people to be home health care aides, might that bring at least some of these people back into the job market? Could it make a difference in that realm?
You know, it's an interesting question, and really I think there's, you know, we definitely make the argument that there's a government role here in improving the quality of these jobs. But what's, I think, pretty shocking to people is that there really is very little, if any, training required to do most home care jobs. The federal standards for training of home health aides haven't changed since 1987, and they're not very rigorous. For personal care aides, there are no federally required minimum training standards. So these really, there's really a low barrier of entry to these types of jobs. So I don't really think that that the reason that people aren't accessing these jobs is because they don't have the training. Rather, I think that these jobs are actually really generally of pretty poor quality. We see pretty low wages across the board. For home care workers, they hover right around $10 an hour or lower. In some parts of the country, they're considerably lower. And actually, home care workers, up until October of this past year, were not covered under the federal minimum wage and overtime laws. So they didn't even have basic labor protections that would guarantee them minimum wage and overtime pay. So really, you know, these wages are, I mean, these jobs are very low wage and there's very few employment protections. And, you know, workers that do this work are actually so poor that more than 50% of them rely on some form of public assistance in order to make ends meet. And, you know, a lot of them are uninsured because there's just very few benefits associated with this work. And, you know, the hours of this type of work tend to be pretty unpredictable, so there's not really a consistent source of income for these workers. So what we advocate for at PHI is really improving the quality of these jobs, and that's definitely a means to ensure that there's enough high-quality workers to do this kind of work as the population ages and the demand increases for these jobs. As I mentioned before, there's really virtually no training, so that's another thing that we advocate for, is that there be better preparation that's targeted for the types of workers that might be drawn to this, so that, you know, we promote adult-centered, adult learner-centered, person-centered training, so that people learn how to do this work even with low literacy skills, and really are able to apply the skills when they perform these services and supports in an effective way. So I think there's a lot of government roles around that area, and I think that improving that would make these jobs a draw for people.
Now, you talk about training, and an interesting question comes up. I understand there is some skill involved in being a home health care aide, skill in the sense of knowing how to properly lift somebody, get them into a wheelchair, get them out of a wheelchair. I do understand that. But isn't some of this things that's very hard to teach in training? Isn't a lot of this work simply having compassion and understanding and patience for the person with whom you're working? And can you really train somebody to that?
I believe, and I think we as an organization believe, that there is a role for training, even in those skills that you just mentioned, compassion and communication and understanding, and the types of training that we actually do and that we advocate for really focuses on communication and understanding, you know, the self-determination of the client that you're working with. So it's really about kind of cultural sensitivity and all sorts of things that people don't necessarily inherently know, but could learn and really improve that. And then there are those physical tasks that you mentioned, the lifting, the bathing, the grooming, the feeding, and all the things that come along with that are very important for people to know how to do. So I really do think it's the type of job that there's a lot, you know, training is very important to ensure that these workers really are able to, you know, perform their jobs at, you know, with the utmost high quality standards, you know. So it definitely does require compassion, and I think that people who naturally have that probably will excel at this type of work, but I think there's room for people to learn as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, the inevitable question, if you have an elder who needs a home health care aide many hours a day, possibly full time, that's expensive. Mm-hmm. Wonderful, the idea of raising the salary and the training for home health care mm-hmm. aides, but mightn't this price some people out of the market? Might somebody say, hey, wait a minute, I can't pay $20 an hour. I'm either going to take care of this person myself, I'm going to put them in a home and let the Medicaid take care of them. Isn't there a danger of pricing people out of the market?
You know, absolutely. I think you could say that about a lot of different services and occupations, you know, that increasing the labor standards could increase the cost. One important thing to know about home care is that really the majority of those services are already being funded through Medicaid programs. In the home health care services industry, actually, it's nearly 75% of the revenue in that industry comes from government-funded programs. So considering that so much of it is already funded by government, there's definitely a role that government plays in improving things like reimbursement rates so that agencies can direct more money towards wages and benefits for the workers. But in terms of the private pay side, I think there's a lot of things that can be done that may ultimately reduce the profits of home care agencies, but improve the conditions for the workforce. And I just don't think we should be balancing, you know, our long-term care system on the backs of the lowest wage workers. I don't think that that's a workable long-term solution to our country's, you know, needs in the area of long-term care.
Now, when you're talking about home health care workers, particularly for the elderly or even in a nursing home, although maybe less in a nursing home, aren't most of these workers older themselves? And I say older, I don't mean 90, but I mean 50 or above. Isn't it skewed in that direction?
You know, it used to be, it's becoming less so. It used to be that there was a, you know, very significant number of workers that were, say, over age 55. But in the past couple of years, and I think this has to do just with the labor market, we see more young people coming to these occupations. I think because, you know, there's just fewer options for them. But you know, in nursing homes, that tends to be where more of the younger workers are employed.
Mm-hmm.
And in home care, we see you know, a larger proportion, relatively, of old of workers over the age of 55. So, I would say almost a third of personal care aides, those are workers who provide home care, are over the age of 55 currently.
Mm-hmm. What's fascinating to me is if somebody, I'm going to put in a figure, 64, was taking care of a young child, people would kind of roll their eyes a bit. You know, how can you keep up with that young child? How can you lift that young child?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have the energy to deal with that young child? But if somebody 64 was taking care of somebody 80, goodness, you'd get less of that. And they may have to lift this person. They may have to push the wheelchair. There may be a lot of physical work involved in it. So there seems like there may be a real disconnect there.
You know, I think that's a really good point. And, you know, another thing that people don't realize about this work is that it's inherently dangerous work and that the injury rates, especially in nursing homes, are higher than for most other occupations in the country. So we're talking about pretty dangerous jobs and physically taxing work. And you're absolutely right that, you know, when older workers who may have age-related limitations of their own or chronic diseases of their own that they're managing, when they're faced with the kind of work that, you know, adds to that physical burden, you know, it could be problematic, especially we're in that gap before people qualify for Medicare. If they don't have health insurance and, you know, and a very small, you know, well, a very large percentage of home care workers are uninsured, you know, they may not be getting the proper, you know, medical care that they need. And you know, they're performing very dangerous work on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did you happen to become involved with PHI National?
You know, I actually came from the aging world myself. My previous experience was mostly focused on aging and aging policy issues, especially around mental health for the geriatric population. But right before I joined PHI, I was working with the New York City Medicaid home care program. So I became more involved in home care that way. And since I've joined PHI, my focus has really shifted to more of the labor issues. But I still see the connection to aging because, you know, this is the workforce that, you know, is necessary to support, you know, our aging population, you know, my parents as they get older, you know. So I see the connection to, you know, to my background that way.
Now, how can somebody get in contact with PHI National if they want to?
Well, you could go to our website, which is phinational.org, and you can learn about our programs there and find contact information for our staff there. you know, we love to answer questions and, you know, talk about the work that we do.
Now, how do you see yourself personally being involved in aging issues, in direct care issues in 5 years? You see yourself trying to make adjustments with the time in PHI? How do you think this is going to change in the next 5 years? Surely there'll be more home health care aides or direct workers. How else do you think it might change?
You know, I think that there's a big shift happening in the policy environment around coordinating care, long-term care with acute care. And I think that this is a really important place that direct care workers could be very valuable, you know, in care teams with doctors, with nurses, helping to manage the chronic conditions of the people that they're serving. So we're working on the policy side at more advanced roles for these workers on care teams and promoting that to different states as they kind of change the structure of their Medicaid programs.
Abby, thank you very much for being a guest on the show, and good luck with your work. It's Harriet Tramer. To find out more about age and aging, go to my blog, www.htramer.com, and I hope you will join us every other Tuesday afternoon at this time when I host Reaching for the Gold. Thank you.